From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We start to view Russian propaganda like a virus. To stop this virus, we should treat it like one.
That was Peter Duran from the Center for European Policy Analysis speaking before the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs Thursday.
So curing those who may have been exposed, defending people by educating citizens to protect themselves and others, and disarming it or finding a vaccine.
Meanwhile, as Democrats and Republicans and an alphabet city of NGOs and corporate media outlets up the ante in their anti-Russian fervor, the U.S. military buildup around Russia and China continues, with the latest being the installation of a THAAD missile system in South Korea intended as an anti-ballistic missile defense. In the midst of all of that, the anti-war movement seems unable to find a champion, attacking both the militarists and the Trump administration, which is under attack for wanting better relations with Russia. For more on all that, we spoke with Professor Anthony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Friday.
Well, you know, as we have discussed in the past, we're looking at what is a slow-moving coup d'etat. And, you know, it's very interesting. You can have a coup d'etat without removing the person who was the target of it from office. You just render him or her, in this case him, powerless. And of course, these constant attacks, really, which are being hatched in the deep state, what we call the deep state, which is the national security state, and being trumpeted in the corporate media and by the neoliberal establishment and by a huge part of the left is a campaign after less than 2 months in office to render Trump impossible to govern. He will be a president without power. So that's what I think we're looking at.
You know, in terms of making the country ungovernable, or in terms of capturing the state while leaving the you know, the particular officials in place, which is what I think we're seeing the attempt with some success against Trump. Well, look, I'm thinking in particular about the situation where vis-a-vis Russia, which is the point really of distinction. The question of war and peace is the point of distinction between Trump and this deep state, real state, the interest behind it, however you want to term it. The point of divergence is this question of war and peace. And we're having, instead of a discussion of that, and ways of trying to find a path to peace through the morass, people raising the question of an false equivalency, that Trump is identical to or just as bad as this, you know, historical monster, the face of global imperialism at this moment. And what do you think about this?
Well, you know, I agree, war and peace, but really, let's be more specific. Peace or nuclear war,
right?
And as every sane and rational observer has said, and I'm talking about people who have some expertise or a lot of expertise in the question of Soviet American Russian American relationships. Are saying, and of course they're being erased from the corporate media discussion of these matters, but as almost all of them are saying, the policy that Trump inherited from the Obama administration is a policy of confrontation and of war that could become a nuclear war. Hence, because of the strategic alliance between Russia and China and Iran and maybe even Turkey, could become what in all measures is a world war. So this is what we're looking at. And anyone that superficially thinks about this as though we're looking at normal party politics, as in stop Trump and the Republicans and the Democrats, that is not what we're faced with. What we're faced with is a deep state or a real state or a party of war which transcends both of the so-called parties of the duopoly. They have committed and invested enormous resources in containing Russia and China, and in so doing have pushed them together. Now, the other false claim, and this is from the liberals and the left, which in many ways are indistinguishable, and in many ways this goes back to 2008 and Obama and the left collapsing in the face of that, this claim of fascism, that on November 8th, we elected a fascist. Mm. Just on the electing a fascist. First of all, in the United States, the fascists don't run for elections. And that's the meaning, frankly, of what we call the deep state, the real state, not the government. On November the 8th, we elected a president who was empowered to put together a government and, as the executive branch, would work with the Congress and be checked by the courts and you know, whatever this balance of American democracy is supposed to be. But that's not the issue at all. The issue is some people call it the party of war, others call it the deep state, with a long-term agenda of eviscerating Russia by demonizing Putin, and we can't take regime change in Russia off of the table, and isolating China, the Obama pivot to Asia. Now, if you're not talking about that, you're really only a part of the echo chamber created by the neoliberal elites. And in this regard, my last point is that what is called the hard left, the real left, which is really a dogmatic, almost cultish movement, has really gotten it completely wrong and now find themselves trapped in a corner which they can't come out of. And the question for them, to what extent are you all a part of the party of war, the neoliberal elite, who have committed themselves to a stop Trump, impeach Trump, get Trump out of office over the question of peace or nuclear war? And that's as simply as I can put it.
And, you know, it may not be as, it may not follow as long an arc or be as hypothetical or theoretical as all that may sound as it actually plays out. We're looking at a condition where on January 20th, after having been driven together by the Obama administration and the Bush administration and the Clinton administration's policies, but really accelerated under the Obama administration, Russia and China find themselves surrounded by the U.S. military from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula with active, troop activity, with actual active troop activity, at those borders. You have drills that go on in the Baltics and in the Balkans. You have the U.S. Navy in the Black Sea. You have the stuff going on, poking and prodding in the South China Sea. You have the joint U.S.-Japanese mock invasion of North Korea the other day that provoked the four-missile response. All of this going on, so that there's essentially, if they're not trying to induce a state of siege or a siege mentality in the governments of Russia and China, certainly that possibility exists, because as they conduct these drills, the only way that the military on the other side knows that it's a drill is if it stops at the border. That's the way they conduct them. They do them hot. They've got anti-missile systems hot in Bulgaria and elsewhere on the Western Front. And now the installation of a THAAD anti-ballistic missile system in Korea, which both Russia and China said was a no-no. And we got to go back to October of 1962, when the installation of some intermediate-range ballistic missiles in Cuba that they figured, and it turned out, according to historians, it's true, contained a few dozen nuclear warheads. These were considered game changers in the balance of power at that point in time, to the point that it required an immediate response to the threshold of nuclear war in 1962, the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis. Everyone remembers that. Well, when they turn on the THAAD missile system in Korea, it may well be that Russia and China, their military does the calculus and says this can take our deterrent out at the source. We cannot allow it to happen. And there's a phone call made to the White House or the Pentagon or whoever the hell they call to talk actual turkey. We may never hear about that phone call, but in the event they say, okay, well, we're going to war to Trump, and he says no, they're going to slide him out. Now, it may be that that's something that happens so fast that nobody knows about it, or it may be that they have to remove him with some kind of popular support, and these people may well be marching to remove him so that a nuclear war can be held.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what's happening. I mean, I don't think there's any other way to look at this. I recall your interview with John Walsh, and he spoke in very plain terms that the overarching issue, in an immediate sense, even more than global warming, is the threat and real possibility of nuclear war. And you mentioned the THAAD missiles and South missile defenses, so-called, in South Korea, but similar missile defenses are in Eastern Europe. And the military buildup in Poland and the Balkans and Bulgaria, I think Romania. I mean, this is huge. This is a level of great power, belligerency, and tension that the world has not seen since 1962. And if you will recall, the U.S. justified its position against Cuba and hence against the Soviet Union based upon the Monroe Doctrine, a sphere of influence. And as a, and I put quotes, great power, the United States said that the Soviet Union should respect the fact that the Americas, including the Caribbean, was a part of America's sphere of influence.
Right.
But no one else is supposed to have a sphere of influence, of course.
Not even at their own borders.
Not even at their own borders. And so this encirclement, military encirclement of Russia and China is a desperation move, in my opinion, because it puts together one of the militarily most sophisticated nations in the world, and here I'm talking about Russia, with the second largest economy in the world, and that's China, in a strategic alliance. And it, to this alliance is being attracted nations like the Philippines, and I continue to say this, maybe Turkey.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if this is not a part of the political discussion of how we fight fascism and war in this country, if this geostrategic picture, this landscape, is not a part of the discussion, it's a child's discussion. It's infantile. It has nothing to do with the variables that constitute the real world. The anti-war movement expressed itself on November 8th. Did that mean that the 60 million or so people who voted for Trump were all anti-war? Of course I'm not saying that. But a strong impetus, especially coming from the working class, this is interesting, was about no to TPP, renegotiate NAFTA, and we don't want war with Russia. And polling data continues to show that the Trump voters are more adverse to war with Russia than the Hillary Clinton voters. The other thing, and this is what we have to take into account, and here is the so-called left collapsing in the face of actual political reality. Trump's favorable numbers, although low, are higher than Hillary Clinton's by 10 points, higher than the Republican Party, higher than the Democratic Party, higher than the corporate media, higher than the Congress by 20 points.
Right. I know.
So in spite of everything, there is a movement out there which is not completely articulated, which is, in fact, in my opinion, the anti-war movement. And that's the real. Now, a lot of people say, but yet he wants war with Iran. Well, you know, there's a certain logic to peace with Russia. Peace with Russia makes it difficult. And you know, by the way, let me put parenthetically, to have invested so much political capital, that is Trump, in this question of peace with Russia. You know, either as Rachel Maddow and others say, he and Julian Assange and Putin are locked in some kind of evil cabal to bring down democracy in the United States and Western Europe. That's one explanation.
Yeah, right.
Or he's a madman, you know.
Right.
That's another explanation. Professor Tribe from Harvard University and others who want to deploy the 25th Amendment.
Right.
Or, and this is what I think you and I are saying, there is something genuine about his position of no war with Russia, of detente with Russia, of recalibrating the relationship with Russia. The other thing, lastly, we have to look at this from the perspective of the failed foreign policy of the Obama administration. The Obama administration, following the Bush administration, has created chaos, a refugee crisis, failed states throughout the Middle East and North and Northeast Africa. Everyone knows that.
Yep.
Its policies towards China, that is the pivot towards Asia, we now can deduce was deeply unpopular with a good part of the American people, maybe half of the American people. And certainly, tensions with Russia were rejected on November 8th. How do you know this? Trump invested so much political capital.
Yeah, they talk about trying him for treason and such. I think that that is certainly, if you just got elected president and the media wants to try you for treason, I would say that you've spent some political capital on
Absolutely.
Something.
Or, I mean, you know, you talk about trying him for treason. What about Rosa Brooks writing in what is now the house organ of the Party of War, Foreign Policy magazine,
right,
writing that one option to get rid of Trump is to have a military coup d'etat? Or what does it mean when David Brooks goes on a radio interview show in New York and says, well, I forgot when I talked about the ways we could get rid of Trump, which were impeachment or resignation. He said, I forgot one thing, assassination.
Right.
I mean, you know, what is a peace movement that does not have politics that reflect the real situation of the conflict and clash of political forces? And may I just say one thing? You know, a lot of people are trying to connect, I think in a reductionist way, all of what Trump says or does in foreign policy to his economic and financial or real estate interests.
Right.
I think that's problematic.
Yep.
You know, sometimes ideological relations and political relations do not just neatly reflect the economic and financial interests, let us say, of the person who is at the head of a movement. You know, it is quite possible, and I think we saw this, Don, in Cleveland in particular, that Trump could be reflecting the interests of a good part of those 60 million people that voted for him.
That's right.
Especially the people in the Rust Belt. I don't think that is lost on him. You understand what I'm saying? I don't know whether I'm making myself clear enough.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, essentially.
Admitted this. He was transformed over the course of the election. He saw things that he was not aware of. And here is where class issues, especially issues of the working class and the poor, become paramount in the politics of the nation. And if I might just lastly say, what goes for the left is so separated from the working people of this country that it's very difficult to call them anything other than liberals or a tail of the liberal elite.
Yeah. So, you know, the question becomes, if we have this, the actual anti-war movement, which is latent, came out and voted. Some came out and voted, by the way, for Clinton, thinking that Trump was, you know, the whole media portrayal of him was he was going to be a madman with his finger on the button. And so some people voted against him, believing that to be the case, thinking they were voting for peace. And then half the electorate didn't vote at all. I'm certain that some of those people likewise prefer peace over nuclear war. And the polling data shows that the large majority of the American people prefer peace over war. Mm-hmm. The question is, when you have on the one hand the Democrats who are almost actively screaming for war with Russia,
mm-hmm,
and Trump, who is being portrayed as the madman with his finger on the button and or the equivalent of those others, how exactly does a leadership of the would-be leadership of the anti-war movement organize it and put it to work within the context of, you know, here's the president who's making these policy attempts, attempting to actualize these policies towards Russia, China, and others. These people who control the Congress and the courts and a lot of people in the streets and the so-called left next to them clamoring for, well, the so-called left isn't clamoring for war with Russia, but they're standing next to people who are thinking that as everyone signed that says in big letters, dump Trump, their sign saying no war in small letters is going to carry the day in the sea of bodies that have a whole lot of other small labels on it, including war with Russia, hammers and sickles with Trump's name and all of that. How do we get from here to there?
Well, first of all, you know, even though the infantile left, the dogmatic left, thought incorrectly that the liberals and the liberal media would animate hundreds of thousands of people to take to the streets against Trump, and they would get in it and, in fact, in front of it and grow their numbers. A lot of them think only from the standpoint of their organizations and not the from the standpoint of all of humanity or of the working class of this country. They would somehow, and this is unfortunate, and I don't like saying it, some of it is because of their narrowness, and some of it is because of their theory of the revolutionary process, would sacrifice a good part of humanity to bring about the, quote, revolution. So they're clamoring to get rid of Trump, joins them at the hip with the party of war and the deep state and the CIA. In fact, one of them said in an article, and this is not the the small left or the dogmatic left, but the broad liberal left, one of them wrote in Vanity Fair that bring the deep state on to bring Trump down.
Yep.
But that's implicit in the discourse. I don't care whether you take people like Maxine Waters of the Congressional Black Caucus or some of those from the alleged peace movement who are so passionate in their opposition to Trump that they're blind almost to all of the other variables at play and who they are objectively aligned with. So where do we go from here? I think, as we have said before, you know, confidence in the working people, help to connect the issues of war and peace to the issues of the economy. We cannot and should not rely upon Trump or his people to articulate a vision beyond what they have already done. And of course, Trump's policies are very contradictory in other ways. I mean, this $54 billion for the military, you know, that's a problem. It's wrong. People in his administration, I don't say they're worse than what Obama had, Leon Panetta. You don't get any worse than that.
Right.
The appointments to the CIA and the National Security Agency, you don't get worse than that. Newlin and Powers and Rice and these actors, I mean, these are cold-blooded imperialists and war makers and coup plotters. So you don't get worse than that. So Tillerson or Mattis, in my opinion, may be a move backward from those people, from the Obama administration. But the responsibility falls upon us to educate the masses, to be a part of a broader discourse, to understand what the most recent polling data is suggesting about where the American people are in terms of war and peace, jobs, and such. So that's the way I go about it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.